In the sermon time today, I want to continue with part three of our Sabbath food Bible studies. And today we're going to concentrate on Exodus chapter 16. So if you want to be turning there, and please, if you've got a bookmark, get your bookmark ready, because we're going to base ourselves in Exodus 16. We're going to be hopping around different places. There's a couple of bookmarks right there if you need them. Excuse me. Not going to go over all that we've done so far. We'll be mentioning some of it as we go through. But last month in part two, we finished off in Exodus chapter 12, where we left our Israelite forebears in the Goshen district of Egypt. And what were they doing there? Well, firstly, they were relearning God's laws for the spring holy days, specifically for Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the annual Sabbath in the spring, and they were preparing their food for that Passover, of course, and for that exceptional Feast of Unleavened Bread when God first freed them from Egypt. But now today, let's move on a little in time and place, and let's visit them again on the road. He said, and in my notes I've got here, it said, not really on the road, but out in the wilderness. But I was reading a bit about it this morning in Barnes' notes, in his commentary, and he actually says that the Egyptians actually did keep that as a road, that way up there was a pretty serviceable road. Okay, Exodus chapter 16, beginning verse 1. And they, the Israelites of course, took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. So here we find them then, our Israelite forefathers, on the 15th day of the second month, just 1 month after the first day of Unleavened Bread, just 1 month after their start of their long trek. Now, perhaps appropriately, in English anyway, they were in the wilderness of Sin. They were near, if you have maps at the back of your Bible or whatever, if you look that up, you'll see that wilderness of Sin is near the eastern shore of the Gulf of Suez, which if you look at a map, you'll see the Red Sea is like a hand given the victory V sign, and it would be the Gulf of Suez is like the west or left finger of the Red Sea. Again, they were between Elim and Sinai, where they would soon, in a couple of days, that they would soon arrive and receive the Ten Commandments codified and written on two stone tablets, if you will, cast in concrete. But in Exodus 16, they were not there yet. They were not at Sinai yet. And that's important as we read on. Here we see our Israelite ancestors just 1 month away from their escape from Egypt. And a question, were they still leaping with happiness, with a high hand, as they had been 1 month earlier, because God had so miraculously freed them from slavery? Well, the answer is no. Despite all of the miracles that they'd so recently witnessed, what were they doing? Let's look at verse 2. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said unto them, Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. I've said this before and I'll say it again. There's an old saying that the first victim of war is truth. But in this case, for these ungrateful, rebellious people, we see that the first victim of freedom was truth. Can we really believe that they had been truly been so well, very well fed back in Egypt? A little bit later, we're going to be referring to Numbers chapter 11, and in a later round of murmuring that we read about in Numbers 11, you don't have to turn there now, I'll just quote it, the Israelites' memories had become even more faulty, and they whined, and this is in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 5, "We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic." Makes my mouth water just thinking about it. But the thing is that they were rebellious and they were murmuring against God who brought them out of Egypt. And God probably should have rained fire and brimstone on them. But what did he rain down on them in his mercy? Back in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 4. "Then said the Eternal unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread." The Hebrew word is lechem, also can mean food or meat. "I will rain bread from heaven for you." In giving them what they craved, he didn't give them what they deserved. He was being merciful and he was being loving. But he was also testing their attitudes. Look at the second half of verse 4. "The people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day." Look what he says. "That I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no." What did he say? "In my law or no." Please remember those words, "my law." And please remember that they had not yet arrived at Sinai. They had not yet received the stone tablets with the Ten Commandments written on them. And yet God's law, and specifically the Sabbath commandment, was in force, in full force. Of course it was. Last month we, in part two, we read that the seventh day was blessed by God, was sanctified, and it was set in force, not at Sinai, but at creation. Okay, verse 5. "And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." Now, this is the first scriptural mention of what we call the day of preparation. And in this case, it was a Friday. It was the day prior to the weekly Sabbath days, actually Thursday at sunset to Friday at sunset. But as we find in other scriptures, that the day of preparation is applicable as well to the annual holy days. Okay, verse 6. "Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, At evening, then you shall know that the Eternal has brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning, then you shall see the glory of the Eternal, for that he hears your murmurings against the Lord, against the Eternal. And what are we that you murmur against us?" So God, through Moses and Aaron, gave them notice here to the Israelites that two great miracles were soon to take place. And the first one, which was to take place that evening, was the giving of quails, as we'll read in a minute, for meat. Now I believe that the quails, before we get into it, was a one-time miracle. Actually, I shouldn't say that. It was more accurately, it was a two-time miracle, because God repeated it some time later again in Numbers chapter 11. Don't need to turn there. But what I mean is that the quail was, okay, a two-time miracle, whereas the manna was repeated every single day for 40 years. every single day for 40 years. Now, verse 6 of Exodus 16 tells us that this quail's miracle was intended to remind the Israelites that it was God who miraculously brought them out from their Egyptian captivity. And verse 7 tells us that the recurring miracle of the manna was a strong daily and weekly reminder of two things, of God's glory, of Yahweh's glory, and also that he could hear the complaints of the Israelites, not just the complaints, but he could hear their words, all of their words, he could see their deeds, and he could even read their thoughts. We find that in other scriptures. Now together, these two great miracles were a warning to the Israelites not to murmur against God, not to murmur against Yahweh, who had been so very good to them. Why bite the hand that feeds you? There's also, brethren, a strong reminder to us, to you and me, as spiritual Israelites. Now, this is important what we're going to read now, because all of the experiences, all of the experiences that happened to our Israelite forefathers are examples for our learning and our benefit today. I wanted to bookmark Exodus chapter 16. We're going to digress for a couple of minutes and we're going to go over to the New Testament and see what it says there. And these are important scriptures. What have I got? Three of them by the Apostle Paul. Romans chapter 15, please. Romans chapter 15. Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. From the scriptures, he says. Now, what were the scriptures that Paul is referring to here? Well, the only scriptures that they had access to then were what we call the Old Testament scriptures. And God inspired the Apostle Paul to write to the wayward Corinthian congregation about this very time period of Exodus 16 and also Numbers 11 as well. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. First Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, obviously the Red Sea. Now look what it says in verse 3. Jump over to verse 3. And did all eat the same meat. No, the same spiritual meat. The Greek word for meat here is broma. It means can mean food or victuals as well as just meat. And just like the Corinthians, a long time later, the Israelites' problem was a spiritual one. They did all eat the same spiritual meat. Okay, jump down to verse 6. Now, these things were our examples. The things that the Israelites did and how they were punished and the commands that they were given are all our were for our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Paul says, neither be you idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 3,000. That was in the Numbers 11 account. neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. That's kind of a really interesting verse, that one, because just by the way, that's another proof that Jesus Christ is the Yahweh of the Old Testament, right there, because the Israelites tempted Jesus Christ. Okay, verse 10, neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. As all for our benefit, brethren, all for our benefit. And I wanted us to read these verses from the Apostle Paul, because I want you to know, I want us to know, that what is written and commanded in Exodus chapter 16 and Numbers 11 as well, was not just for the ancient Israelites during that specific manna period of their wilderness wandering, not just limited to them, but it's for us as well. One more quote then from God through the Apostle Paul to show us that these Old Testament verses are applicable to us. 2 Timothy chapter 3, please. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 14. 2 Timothy 3:14. But continue you in the things which you have learned and have been assured of, knowing of whom you have learned them. And that from a child you, Timothy, have known the holy scriptures, which are able to make you wise unto salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Again, what were the holy scriptures that are mentioned there that young Timothy had known since his childhood? Again, they are the scriptures that we call the Old Testament scriptures, and they're applicable for our benefit today. Verse 16, all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. And we can't take pieces out of the Old Testament and say that those things that, you know, somebody, people will say, what's the use of the book of Esther, or what's the use of the book, you know, there's benefit for us all in every single one of those scriptures. So that's important. So again, please remember these verses as we continue, not just today, but with future parts of this series as well. Nehemiah is one that comes to mind there, and we're going to get into that. I'm tempted to dig into it now, but I won't. We'll carry on. But don't discount Nehemiah as saying that that doesn't apply to us. It very, very much does. Okay. Proper observance of God's weekly and annual Sabbath days and their associated days of preparation are repeated, ongoing reminders to us how this same Lord, the same Yahweh, the same I Am, brought us, you and me, out of our slavery in spiritual Egypt. We're going to be learning about this in a couple of months' time at the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We were in spiritual Egypt. Jesus Christ, the Yahweh of the Old Testament, brought us out of that, brought us out of the world, spiritual Egypt, and the way of life of the spiritual Pharaoh, which we know to be Satan. Okay, let's go back to Exodus 16 again, please. Exodus chapter 16. Exodus 16, and we're up to verse 8. And Moses said, this shall be when the Eternal shall give you in the evening flesh, which is quail, of course, to eat, and in the morning bread, which is the manna, to the full. For that the Eternal hears your murmurings which you murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Eternal. And Moses spoke unto Aaron, say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Eternal, for he has heard your murmurings. And Moses just kept hammering them with that, kept repeating that those words, murmur and murmuring, and he wasn't letting the Israelites off the hook. They were not to forget, they were never to forget their chronic repeated sin of murmuring. And brethren, we need to learn that lesson as well. Verse 10, and it came to pass, as Aaron spoke unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Eternal appeared in the cloud. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak unto them, saying, at even you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Eternal your God. And it came to pass that at evening, the quails came up and covered the camp. That's amazing. There must have been, I don't know, millions of them. I was reading about that as well in the Barnes notes and some other commentaries this morning. Apparently, not discounting that miracle, not at all, but that there were that those quails in that area still to this day, they flock in huge flocks, and at different times of the year they do move in there, you know. But I mean, the miracle, what still was a huge miracle. Quails, have you ever eaten quail? Never yet. I had it once years and years ago, and I went to a business dinner in a posh Victoria restaurant there, and I had quail there. It was very nice tasting meat. I believe that the quails are North American quails are a lot smaller than the ones over in that area. The North American one's very small bird, and they're even smaller than a Cornish game hen. You know, you've seen those in the store. And anybody who's got a fair appetite, like I do, would need at least two of these things to make a decent meal. So they're quite small. I think it's when I was reading about them, apparently those ones in the Middle East are actually bigger. They're about the size of a pheasant or a larger pigeon anyway. Okay. But again, I just want to repeat that. It's my understanding that these quails were not an ongoing miraculous food source from God for the Israelites, as was the manna. As far as I can, in my understanding, that it was a two-time thing. It was a blessing the first time. This first time in Exodus chapter 16, it was a blessing on the Israelites as well as a warning and a reminder for them. But the second time in Numbers 11, it was a curse on them because they hadn't learned that lesson. Okay, still second half of verse 13 shows us that the Israelites' ongoing daily miraculous source of food was the manna. Second half of verse 13, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host, means about the camp, the wilderness. It's called the fields. I don't think they were really fields, but the land that was outside the camp there. Verse 14, and when the dew that lay was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoarfrost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, In the King James it said, it is manna. But in the English it is, what is it? He said, what is it? For they knew not what it was. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread which the Eternal has given you to eat. So they said, what is it? And we look back and we've never seen it. We say, what was it like? Well, Moses describes it as round and as small as the hoarfrost. I'll read you an excerpt from my encyclopedia article on hoarfrost. This is what it says. Hoarfrost is also called radiation frost or pruina, and it refers to the white ice crystals loosely deposited on the ground or exposed objects that form on cold, clear nights when heat losses into the open skies cause objects to become colder than the surrounding air. Depth hoarfrost refers to cup-shaped crystals on the surface. Cup-shaped crystals. And a cup shape is really interesting because the term hoarfrost in Exodus 16:14 is translated from the Hebrew noun kephaur, K-E-P-H-O-W-R, which can also mean basin or bowl. And this gives me the idea anyway that the flakes of manna were perhaps something like flakes of a breakfast cereal, perhaps something like Kellogg's bowl-shaped Special K. Have you ever seen Special K? And they're kind of a little tiny bowl-shaped thing, only they're sweetened. And I thought to myself, you know, God was so good to them that if they were little flat things that they were right down on the ground, it'd be hard to collect those things, you know. If they were like a bowl shape and there was stacks of them, it would be so much easier for them to collect them. You know, so he thought of everything. So if you just jump down just for a minute there to verse 31, it gives some more information on it, because it says here that they were sweetened. Verse 31 says, it was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Again, you don't have to go there, but Numbers 11 and verse 7 agrees with this. I'll just read it to you. The manna was as coriander seed, and it adds, the colour thereof was as the colour of bdellium, which I understand to be like a pearly white colour. So you can imagine basically what it looked like. Maybe like Special K, only white. But this was really special stuff. God gave this manna the property of breeding worms and stinking just after just one day's storage. And that means that it must have had much more to it than mere cereal. It wasn't just Special K. I mean, it was special. It was special. What's it? So there's got to have been more to it than mere cereal, because mere cereal can remain fresh or relatively fresh for much longer than just a day. But also, if God designed this as a single, remember those quail, you know, they were a temporary luxury, but they didn't come every day. This did. And if God was going to design one single perfect food source for the Israelites, it makes sense that he would imbue it with all the necessary ingredients for the maintenance of good nutrition and health. Now perhaps, I don't know, perhaps there's an even deeper symbolism in the short-term perishability of manna. There probably is. I haven't really looked into that part of it. I may be totally unaware of it, but there probably is some deeper symbolism. Okay, let's go back to where we left off in Exodus 16 and verse 16 now. This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded. Gather of it every man, according to his eating. An omer, and there's arguments over the size of an omer, at different times it changed, but if we look at the regular Omer, it's apparently about 3.64 litres or 3.2 quarts, somewhere in that area. Could be, you know, that's subject to argument. Okay, an Omer for every man, according to the number of your persons, take you every man for them which are in his tents. Okay, so that's interesting. The wording indicates here that each man of the house, or we could call him man of the tent, right, would do the gathering for the whole household, or tent hold, if you will. In other words, probably the way this is worded, the wives and the children wouldn't necessarily have to go out to gather their own individual portions. That's the way that seems to be worded there. Okay, verse 17. And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less. And when they did measure it with an omer, I guess they had some kind of measuring bowl or whatever. He that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. So in the short time that they had every morning to complete their collecting, all of them ended up with one omer per person. Okay? And that is another miracle. Now, you don't have to turn there, but over in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 15, the Apostle Paul again reinforces the authenticity, the New Testament authenticity of Exodus chapter 16. Okay, so the authenticity of this writing being applicable to the Church of God in the New Testament, just by quoting the second half of verse 18 here. And we'll get into that more when we get to the New Testament Sabbath scriptures, but we'll just leave it there for the time being. Let's move on to verse 19, Exodus chapter 16, verse 19. And Moses said, let no man leave of it till the morning. Simple instruction? Yeah. Little kids understand that. Let no man leave of it until the morning. But guess what? Verse 20. Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto Moses, but some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was wroth with them. Verse 21. And they gathered it every morning. Now, the word, one word for the two words every morning is the Hebrew boker, B-O-Q-E-R. Know what it means? It means early morning, right after sunrise. And they gathered it every morning, right after sunrise, every man according to his eating, and when the sun waxed hot, it melted. So, some people say that the manna flakes were so tiny and difficult to collect that it may have taken the Israelites a whole day, every day, to gather their omer. But this is evidently not the case. First of all, if they'd spent most of every day gathering manna, they really wouldn't have been able to travel very far. They wouldn't have got far at all. And secondly, verse 21 here tells us that each man was able, not just able, but even required to gather his allotted portion in the early morning while it was still cool and before the air and the ground temperature became hot. Now once it was collected, another miracle, it didn't go off, it didn't melt, even in their warm tents. It didn't melt. And remember, they didn't have refrigerators like we do. Even on their preparation days, they had ample time in the morning to be able to gather their double portion. Okay, let's look at verse 22. And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, lechem is a word for bread, two omers for one man, And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. They must have said to him, wow, you know, this is a miracle. I want to just read just a note from Barnes' notes here on verse 22. He says, from this passage and from verse 5, it is inferred that the seventh day was previously known to the people as a day separate from all others. And if so, it must have been observed as an ancient institution. Okay, and we know that that's true. I'm going to keep that out because we're going to go back to Barnes again in a minute. Okay, verse 23. And he said to them, this is that which the Eternal has said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Eternal. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Eternal. Brethren, this is a very important, this is a landmark verse because it's the very first appearance in the Bible of the word Sabbath, with two B's. It's the very first appearance that specifies the Sabbath time. I'm not saying it is in this very first appearance. It specifies the Sabbath time as being holy. Remember, we discussed that last time. The Hebrew word is Kodesh, Q-O-D-E-S-H. Remember that from last time. It means dedicated, consecrated, hallowed, for sacred use. This is holy time. Now, the Hebrew word translated into the English Sabbath with two B's is Shabbath with two B's, S-H-A-B-B-A-T-H. And if you want to write it down, it's Strong's 7676. 7676, and it's a noun. It's a noun. Now this noun, Shabbath, is related to the verb Shabbath, which we've looked at already. The noun Shabbath actually stems grammatically from the verb Shabbat with the one B, and we discussed that last month, and we know that it's frequently translated as rest. Now we see the word rest here in verse 23. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. But the word rest here, yes, it does appear, but the Hebrew word for rest here is Shabbathon. Shabbathon, Strong's 7677, S-H-A-B-B-A-T-H-O-W-N. And it's translated in the King James as rest 8 times and Sabbath 3 times. And it can refer to the weekly Sabbath or it can refer to the holy days as well. Now remember, again, I'll repeat this again. The Israelites had not yet arrived at Sinai. Stone tablets containing the codified Ten Commandments had not yet been given to Moses. But it's evident from what we read here that this Sabbath commandment, as well as the other 9, were in effect, in force, and holy at that time, and had been so all the way from creation. Okay. Still in verse 23, what did God command the Israelites in regard to how they should prepare their manna on that preparation day before the weekly Sabbath? Continuing in verse 23, bake that which you will bake today on this day of preparation, and seethe, which can mean boil or roast, seethe that you will seethe, and that which remains over, lay up for you to be kept until the morning. Evidently uncooked, okay? Could they have cooked it? Probably could have, and they could have had cooked manna, I don't know. But, and they laid it up till the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. Yet another wonderful miracle proving the specialness of the Sabbath. Now, two huge questions here for us. Number one, does this command against baking and boiling and roasting on the Sabbath days, does it still apply to us today? And secondly, if so, if it does apply to us today, how far does God want us to take it? The answer to question one, does it apply to us today, is quite simple. In fact, we've already read the answer in God's Word. I want to repeat it. Again, bookmark this, and we're going to go back again, and we're going to repeat what 1 Corinthians 10 said, what we read in 1 Corinthians 10. Because it applies, we want to know whether it applies, whether it applied to the early New Testament church, and so if it did apply to them, then it certainly applies to us as well. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. Verse 3, and did all eat the same spiritual meat. And verse 6, now these things were our examples to the, I know we read it before, but I want to home in on this because it is important. Were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Verse 9, neither let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of the serpents. And verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for ensamples or examples, and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. So how did the church in the wilderness, in Moses and Aaron's time, how did they displease God at that time, in that time of Exodus 16 and Numbers 11? First of all, by continually murmuring against him. They wouldn't let up on that. And secondly, by blatantly disregarding his clear instructions regarding his Sabbath days. They did it here, you know, said, go out on the Friday, collect twice as much, and then you'll have enough for the Sabbath. Some of them didn't do it, you know. They didn't do that. They just collected their one omer, went out there again on the Sabbath. And later on, the other guy there was collecting firewood. We'll come to that, not today, but in a week or two's time. Okay, they blatantly disregarded his clear, simple instructions regarding his Sabbath days. Now, we had two questions there. One of them was, does this command against baking and boiling and roasting on the Sabbath days still apply to us today? I believe it does. Secondly, we said, if so, how far does God want us to take it? Now, the answer to the first question was reasonably clear cut. The answer to the second question is not so clear cut as the first. How far does God want us to take it? The words bake and seethe are quite unambiguous. They're quite easy to understand. So it seems at first glance to be quite simple. What? On God's holy Sabbath days, don't do any baking of bread, of cakes, etc. Going to do that. Don't do any seething, boiling or roasting of meats and vegetables, etc. And I'm sure that virtually all of us agree with these instructions because these activities take quite a lot of work, right? And if desired, if those kind of foods are desired, we should complete the preparation for them on the preparation day. But because today we have the benefit of electric and gas-powered cooking appliances, and most of them are virtually fully automatic and require little or no real work, then some tricky questions often come up. And there's some of them. Can I make toast on the Sabbath from pre-baked, you know, not going to bake bread in order to toast it, but there's a question there. Can I make toast? I'm not ridiculing any of these. These are real questions. Can I warm up previously cooked food items in a regular oven or a microwave oven or in a slow cooker? Can I use a slow cooker to cook fresh? I'm not doing any work, so can I use a slow cooker to cook fresh but previously prepared ingredients? Questions. Can I boil an egg? Can I brew coffee? Can I boil water for tea, for instant coffee, or for hot chocolate? They're just a couple of them. They're real questions, and again, I don't ridicule them, I don't mock them. But I'm not sure, brethren, I'm not totally sure that there's one clear yea or nay for all of these questions. Now, some brethren would answer one way on some of these questions, or all of these questions, and other brethren would answer another way on some or all of them. If we're not sure, if you're not sure, or even if you are sure, if you feel that you're sure in your own mind, then God's Word gives us two pieces of advice. And both of these pieces of advice are what we've concentrated in part one of this series. You don't have to turn to the scriptures if you don't want to, I'll just quote them. Piece of advice number one is, err on the safe side. Romans chapter 14 and verse 23. And he that doubts is damned if he eat, because he eats not of faith. But whatsoever is not of faith is sin. That's number one. Number two is, don't unrighteously judge other brethren for their decisions which you might disagree with. Okay? Colossians chapter 2 and verse 16. I'm going to plug this every single time I give one of these messages because it's very, very important. Let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink, or in respect of a holy day, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath days. So, if we're saying, don't let anybody else judge us with regards to these things, then we're not to judge other people about these things as well. Okay? Be an example? Knock out. Judge people on it? No. Okay, let's go back to Exodus chapter 16 again, where we find our Israelite forefathers still camped in the wilderness of sin on the Sabbath day. Exodus 16. And we'll read verse 25 now. And Moses said, eat that manna today, eat that today, manna, for today is a Sabbath unto the Eternal. Today you shall not find it in the field. I've got another note from Barnes' notes here again on verse 25. And he says, with regards to this verse, he says, the practical observance of the Sabbath was thus formally instituted before the giving of the law. I'm going to read that again. The practical observance of the Sabbath was thus formally instituted before the giving of the law. The people were to abstain from the ordinary work of everyday life. They were not to collect food, nor, as it would seem, even to prepare it as on other days. Okay. Simple? Simple. Okay. Of course, Mr. Barnes probably kept Sunday, you know. Okay, that was verse 25. Okay, verse 26. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, Shebi, remember from last time, Shebi day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. There shall be none. So there's at least two implied commands here in these two verses. Again, two implied commands, both for the ancient Israelites and for God's church today. On God's holy Sabbath days, quite simple, don't do your daily work that is normally done on the other 6 days of the week. Simple. Number two, don't do your food gathering. Okay. Now, in our modern day, okay, we don't collect manna. We don't have to collect manna. That's fine. We don't, in our modern day, we don't have that many farmers in the church anymore. We used to years ago. I don't think there's many farmers in God's church anymore. So the food gathering for most of us may include picking fresh veg from our in the summertime from our backyard vegetable gardens. And for most of us, it would include shopping for food, purchasing food, right, at the grocery store. And also, by extension, if we're out of town somewhere, could involve a restaurant meal away from home. Okay? You agree with that? Yeah. That would be included in the collecting of food, gathering of food. And what God is telling us here is that we will not be blessed if we do these things during God's holy time. Quite the opposite, in fact. Quite the opposite. But guess what some of our Israelite forefathers did? You guessed it, according to their usual form, verse 27. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. At that time, the Israelites were totally and directly dependent on God for their food. Now, we are today, we're still dependent on Him too. You know, if it wasn't for God and the farmers and the stores and everything else, but everything goes back to God's provision. But not as directly as those people were during their 40 years of dependency, total dependency on manna. Now imagine the shock that you'd get if you went to the local supermarket one Sabbath day, just to pick up a couple of items that you forgot to get on Friday, and you found it closed. And there was a sign on the door that said it's closed because God had miraculously emptied the shelves. Imagine that. Or imagine if on your way to church that you stopped by your local Tim Hortons coffee shop one Sabbath day in order to pick up a daily cup of Java, and it was closed because God had miraculously spirited away all the donuts, all the muffins, and all the Colombian dark blend. Imagine that. I mean, I jest, but in effect, that's exactly what God did every single week during those 40 years by giving the Israelites twice as much manna each Friday and withholding his usual daily provision of manna on the Sabbath day. It's exactly what he did. Let's not discount the miracles of God. No, let's not start thinking that, you know, that those, I read somewhere that the manna was kind of stuff that grew in the bark of trees or something like that, you know, and that these, that the quails that came over, they were a natural phenomenon. God did it. There's no doubt about it. God did it. Okay. God performed this weekly miracle for their own good. And remember, we're going to learn more about that later on, but God made his Sabbaths for man, for man's benefit, for both for the short term and long term benefit of man. Now, let's look what the Lord Yahweh said that Sabbath day when he saw the Israelites going out looking for the manna. And again, this is another verse that's very, very significant for us, brethren. Verse 28. And the Eternal said unto Moses, how long refuse you to keep what? My commandments and my laws, My commandments and my laws. Commandments and laws? God's commandments and laws? Weren't these just temporary rules for the provision and the receiving of the Sabbath food? Didn't these things just constitute a separate temporary covenant that is limited to the manna period? Brethren, if you can find any scriptural mention of any such temporary covenant, please let me know. Because I looked it up this morning and I couldn't find one. And between, I believe, covenants is not even mentioned between, I think, Exodus chapter 6 all the way up to Exodus chapter 19. I think that's correct. So certainly no specific separate covenant that covers this period. These are not temporary commands limited to the 40-year manna period when God miraculously provided manna for the Israelites. These are, brethren, eternally binding, God's eternally binding commandments and laws. He says, my commandments and my laws, specifically relating and expanding on his fourth commandment, which he hadn't given them yet, but it was still in force. Remember what we studied last month about Jesus' magnification of his laws. You'll give us the basics and then he'll expand on it. And that's basically what he was doing here. Again, let's bookmark Exodus 16. I just want to blitz through a couple of other scriptures that show and prove that his commandments, that God's commandments and laws are forever. When he says commandments and laws there, there's nothing about anything temporary. Let's read these scriptures. Deuteronomy chapter 5, just single verses here. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 29. Deuteronomy 5, 29. Oh, that there was such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever, forever. Go to chapter 29, still in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 29. The secret things belong unto the eternal our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Forever. Let's go over to Psalms. What, just one more here. Psalm 119. A couple of verses from Psalm 119. Verse 44. Psalm 119. Verse 44. So shall I keep thy law continually forever and ever. And jump over to verse 142. Thy righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and thy law is the truth. The truth. So what I was trying to get at there, brethren, is there's nothing temporary about God's law and commandments. This is it. Okay, let's go back to our bookmark there in Exodus 16. Exodus 16 and verse 29, please. Verse 29. See, for that the Eternal has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide you every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. Now, this verse has been ridiculed, misconstrued, especially the last phrase of that, to mean that God here unreasonably confined the Israelites, and us as well, to their tents and later to their homes and our homes on the Sabbath days. But that's not true. You know, we know very well from Jesus' example, they certainly did not, you know, sit at home every Sabbath day and do nothing. You know that he doesn't want us to do that. This is a misguided idea, and it's what likely led the later Jews to come up with a very unscriptural tradition of the elders with regards to something called a Sabbath day's journey. And you're familiar with that phrase, Sabbath day's journey, which is mentioned by Luke in Acts chapter 1. We're going to discuss that in detail when we get into the New Testament. But no, this command in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 29 was specifically relative to the attempted collection of manna and other work as well. Again, we're going to come to that firewood incident that happened on the Sabbath days. God, the Lord, Yahweh, was warning those who neglected their preparation day duties, warning them not to go out of the tent community on the Sabbath, as they did, into the surrounding countryside. And in verse 25 it talks about what they call fields on the Sabbath day, in rebellious attempts to collect manna. I'm not going to do that. You know, do what I want to do. The manna wasn't there anyway. They went out there. Oh, it's gone. It's not there. So eventually, at the end of all of this, whether they liked it or not, they appeared to get the point. Not sure whether they totally did, as we see in the continuing history, but they appeared to get the point, at least for the time being. And the point was for them, and for us, brethren, to imitate what God did at the end of his recreation work. The Israelites were memory challenged, and we are too. You know, we really are. You know, and we need to, part of why we keep the Sabbath every week, to remind ourselves about these things, to imitate, and this is the point that we have to learn from this, to imitate what God did at the end of his recreation work. I'll quote Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. He rested on the seventh day. Remember this from last month. He Shabbathed on the Shebi'i day. And again, in, as we finish off here, verse 30 in Exodus 16, so the people rested on the seventh day. And that verse is almost, it's almost like a parallel scripture with Genesis 1 verse 2. At long last, the people finally seem to have got the point, and they too Shabbathed on the Shebi'i day. They emulated at last God's example. At last they obeyed his commandment. So brethren, let us do the same. But let's do so without getting God upset at us as they did. Let's learn from their bad example. Let's stop fighting God. Let's emulate God's example and reject the Israelites' example. Let's learn from their bad example. Let's follow God's good example. Let's obey his commandments. Let's Shabbath on the Shebi'i day, God's Kodesh Shabbath day. Let's rest on the seventh day, God's holy Sabbath day.